Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. November 9th, 2023, was that a great or terrible night for Biden edition? I'm David Plotz of CityCast at home in Washington, D.C. Emily Bazelon of the New York Times Magazine and Yale University is at home in New Haven. Hello, at home, Emily.
Hello.
John Dickerson of CBS Primetime is at home in New York City. Hello, at home, John.
Yeah, hi. Hello, Emily. Hi, David. Cheerio.
This week on the Gabfest, Democrats won most of the important races in the off-year election. Why did they thrive? Is Glenn Youngkin toast? Then another dreadful poll for President Biden. Why is he in such big trouble, and can he do anything to turn it around for 2024? And then the Supreme Court found the one gun law that it will uphold. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter. Also, a reminder, we have a conundrum show coming up that we're hoping to do live. In the meantime, we still need your 2023 conundrums. You've gotten us off to a great start. Some conundrums you've sent us already, which maybe we'll discuss. Is it okay to put your trash in someone else's garbage can if you don't have space of your own?
Absolutely not.
Don't just leave it. Leave it. Leave it.
Wow.
This one, which is like my idea of horror, would you rather be trapped on a desert island with Elon Musk or Mark Zuckerberg? Then
it is a bad choice.
We see Roman ruins all over Europe. What will people 25 years from now see of America today? Those are great conundrums.
Those are fantastic. Oh, those my God. Great. That's a whole show.
Yeah. So anyway, please send us your conundrum by going to slate.com/conundrum or slate.com/conundrums, whichever you like, and entering it. And we look forward to reading them and talking about them in December. Tuesday's election night went about as well for Democrats as they could have hoped. They took back the Virginia State House, held the state Senate, thus denying Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin the friendly legislature he desperately wanted. Democrat Andy Beshear was reelected as Kentucky governor in a pretty red state. Voters protected abortion and legalized marijuana by ballot measure in Ohio, which is another victory for the left. The only real cloud on the horizon was failing to defeat a Republican governor in Mississippi. So I live in D.C., which means I've been beset with TV ads for these Virginia House and Senate races for weeks. And I know why Democrats won, because they painted Republicans as MAGA extremists seeking to ban abortion and put doctors in prison. Abortion rights, Emily, seemed like the dominant issue for Democrats this cycle, at least in Virginia and, of course, in Ohio, and it's kind of even in Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting to see that when voters are asked to directly decide this issue, they are opting to protect abortion so far, particularly in states where there is a pretty stark choice. So Ohio had legal abortion until 22 weeks, but it also had a 6-week ban on the books that was being appealed to the conservative Ohio Supreme Court. And so the choice here for voters is, do you want very little access to abortion or do you want broad access? And they chose broad access. It was the measure passed by more than 56%. That percentage also means it was very significant that Ohio voters rejected a measure that Republicans put on the ballot in August that would have raised the threshold for passing this measure and other measures to 60%. So that's notable. And the other thing that was interesting is that the opponents of abortion tried some different strategies this time. They pushed really hard on the idea that parental rights were at stake, even though there was nothing in the abortion rights measure that talked about parental rights. And then also the Secretary of State and the Ohio Ballot Board, which is controlled by Republicans, rewrote the language that voters saw when they actually were looking at the amendment in front of them, like on the ballot. And they made a number of changes. The most significant one was to replace the word fetus with unborn child. And so it was interesting to see that that kind of very anti-abortion rhetoric did not have the intended effect, and the measure passed anyway.
And John, also Virginia Republicans tried to stake out a wholly different kind of position. And that, although I've seen different reports on this, it just does seem like that didn't really hurt them at the ballot box. They actually did relatively well and compared to where they had been, but they still didn't win the elections.
They didn't do as well as they needed to. One of the hopes for Republicans in Virginia was that by reframing or trying to reframe abortion, and Emily, step in and correct me if I'm wrong here, because the language is super important, by Youngkin reframing his abortion policy as a 15-week ban that was common sense and that was not extreme the way Democrats wanted. They tried to shift the way the party talked about abortion, get it away from total bans, get it away from national bans, and try to move the turf onto the extremism of the Democrats. And so it was a test about whether they could, A, change the language, and whether somebody who was non-MAGA affiliated, and we should talk about the sort of fantasy that surrounded Glenn Youngkin in a number of ways, but this was one part of it, was that the governor of Virginia, a Republican who was not closely associated with Donald Trump, could be the vehicle for reframing abortion, and that could then be a template for getting out from under this problem for Republicans. None of that worked. And that's interesting going forward, because not only does it say something about Glenn Youngkin, but it says something about the durability of this issue and the difficulty Republicans are having, and the increasing difficulty they're going to have, because they're going to have a huge fight right now about what to do about the issue. One question about abortion is whether Democrats can keep hitting the abortion issue button going forward, and in what conditions they can do that. And then the other is whether Republicans can do anything to fix the problem their party clearly has on that issue for the next election.
I mean, what was interesting, again, because I saw all these messages, is that so Youngkin was pushing this 15-week ban with exceptions for rape, incest, life of the mother, sensible policy. But if you looked at the Democratic ads, every one was targeted at a candidate. Every ad that I saw about abortion was framing the candidate as somebody who is opposed to abortion in all circumstances, because all of them had signed, every conservative Republican has at some point signed a pledge saying they will, you know, fight to get rid of abortion in all circumstances, and Democrats just put that up. So it didn't even matter that Youngkin was pushing that 15-week, because you just said, oh, this candidate wants to get rid of it all the time and wants to send your doctor to jail. And I thought that was pretty effective, even though that what Youngkin wanted was not what they were fighting him on.
Yeah, and it is the party position. I mean, not that party platforms mean anything anymore, but it is the party position, and it is the position of the Speaker of the House and a major constituency in the party. There's a very funny moment when Sean Hannity, in exasperation, he said, you know, Democrats are trying to make it feel like Republicans want to get rid of abortion in all instances. I mean, it's the party position. That, you know, they may want to fix it. Sean Hannity at one point wanted to fix the Republican Party's position on immigration and support comprehensive immigration reform, a position he's since moved away from. But while individual Republicans may have different positions, there are, you know, the driving force within the party has been that stronger position.
Yeah, I mean, there's a disconnect here. The anti-abortion organizations, the people who work on this, they want no abortion under any circumstances. They deeply feel like this is a moral and in some cases a religious issue. They say that they want to make abortion unthinkable. And that is just really different from where most Americans are when you look at the polls on this. Before the end of Roe, it was possible to kind of imagine that maybe that was not the case. But the polls have shifted now that there are actually states that are banning abortion and there's something actually at risk and at stake. And so the Republicans have a real problem. I mean, a third of Republicans in Ohio support abortion rights.
But abortion rights isn't always on the ballot.
Of course not.
And Republicans need to make sure, they need to work to make sure abortion rights is on the ballot as infrequently as possible.
Yes. When you have candidate races, it's different. And that's part of why you're analyzing the Youngkin issue in a different way, because state legislative races obviously have a whole basket of issues at stake.
Who is Andy Beshear and why does he win when other red state Democrats cannot really win anymore, at least not statewide?
The Andy Beshear situation is really interesting because he is a very popular Democratic governor. So on the one hand, he really associated his opponent's position on abortion rights. So in one sense, he just ran the same play. But he basically was able to talk up Biden policies without ever mentioning Biden's name. He was able to successfully keep it local and keep this from turning into a national election or a referendum on Biden, which would have been really hard to do anyway. But he's also just extremely popular for his response to COVID, for the way he's handled local disasters. And he's a really fascinating case, not only about himself, but just about whether there are bigger groups of swing voters in certain parts of the country than might be otherwise thought.
I mean, are there actual lessons from Andy Beshear for Democrats broadly? Most Democrats are not getting elected in districts where they have a lot of Republican voters. They're not having to govern in a place where they're at risk of losing to a Republican. There are very few Democrats who are leading large reddish areas. So does this lesson apply to somebody who is, you know, the governor of Vermont or something too?
Well, governor of Vermont wouldn't have the same challenges. So the question is, could it have been used, you know, in Mississippi? Different situation. You had an incumbent Republican governor there.
Could it help Sherrod Brown next year running as an incumbent for Senate in Ohio?
I don't know. I mean, governors can do things. Governors play a different role in people's lives than senators do. And it's harder to nationalize a governor's race than it is a senator's race. And so I don't know. I mean, Brown has a real strong ties to Ohio and has his own, you know, I mean, the tester race will test this, whether these longtime senators who have real strengths in their states aren't a creation of a national movement, but have a real connection to their state, whether they can de-link themselves. That's always a question. I think it's a little easier for governors, and governors get to take action and do things in a way that senators sometimes don't because of the way Congress works.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting how often you have a governor of a state which is slightly to the right or to the left of them and governing from the out party, who becomes a national darling. You see that. You saw that with Larry Hogan. You saw it with Mitt Romney. You see it with Glenn Youngkin. You see it with Beshear. And even going back to Bill Clinton, I mean, Arkansas was a Democratic state there then, but it was a conservative Democratic state. It was a Democratic state where it was the old kind of Democrat. And it's not a fantasia of American life, but it's a persistent theme, is find the governor who's governing a state where the people are not aligned with him politically or not aligned with his party, and that's your next president or that's your next national person. But I don't even know if that's actually true.
One of the things that's interesting, and I don't think you can extrapolate anything from it, but one of the things we'll talk about when we talk about the Biden poll is, given that the polling suggests that Joe Biden himself has a problem, and that it's distinct from his party's challenges, which the Democratic Party seems to be able to overcome, the significant effort to try to connect Beshear with Biden failed. The point being, if Biden is toxic, it should have been a little easier to do that. And so it gives us maybe some indication of the toxicity or the contours of Biden's challenge, and Biden as a problem for his party, distinct for Biden as a problem for himself.
I don't want to leave without touching on a point that I saw made by Matt Iglesias, but also I think made by others, which is that it now seems as though high information, high turnout voters are Democrats. And that's what's driving success in off-year elections. Why has that happened? And what is it? What's the significance of that?
I mean, I think what's interesting about this is that in all the fights we had over like voter ID and other kinds of restrictions, Democrats talked themselves into the idea that the more turnout, the better for Democrats. And that has actually not turned out to be really the case. And instead, people who are highly engaged and showing up in these off-year elections, I think probably they're also like more educated. And we have so much polarization between the parties along the lines of who's college educated and who's not, that then that would go to the benefit of Democrats in a way that is kind of out of sync with the image that the party had of itself of representing a lot of low-income people. So then if you make turnout easier, you're going to get other people to the polls who wouldn't normally be there. Those can still be important values, but they don't seem to be tracking with increasing the Democratic margin the way I feel like the rhetoric kind of imagined several years ago.
The political scientist from Michigan State, Matt Grossman, makes this connection with college-educated voters voting more for Democrats and therefore being more tuned in and voting more in off years. And in the Times poll, I believe it's true that Biden, as poorly as he's doing, is doing better with voters who voted, let me make sure I get this right, who voted in the midterms in 2022 than the voters who didn't. So that is to say, the intensely focused on politics voters, the kind of core of his party, rather than the bigger, broader swath of his party.
I'm looking forward to expansive Republican motor voter legislation and Democrats prosecuting voter fraud viciously in Wisconsin.
Can I, one other thing that I forgot to mention about Beshear, because it came up with when I talked to Josh Shapiro, who was the governor of Pennsylvania and who benefited from fixing the road I-95 much faster than anybody expected, which is, man, and you, David, I feel like have said this many, many times over the years, infrastructure, getting stuff done where you can move things around matters. And Beshear focused a lot on infrastructure and also teacher salaries. Again, this focus on close to home, where people in polls tend to show that they actually feel more, they feel better about life than they do their national life and the direction of the country. So he benefits from that disconnect. People are willing to give wins to politicians who are closer to them if those politicians deserve them. Whereas the national picture, maybe people have a much more difficult time recognizing anything going well.
Right. I mean, I go back to that point that David Leinhardt made with us last week, which is that if you look at how long it takes to get from one place to another, it takes more time in 2023 than it did in 1968. For most kinds of transit.
And if you ride the Amtrak Acela train from New York to Washington, you will experience what train travel was like in the mid-18th century, because it's the
tracks. Except with worse food.
And the internet will not work periodically.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Well, mid-18th century.
Exactly right. The internet the internet in 1783 was faster on the train routes than the one on
the Acela. I think we've gone like 17 years on the show and no one has ever made the kind of class limousine liberal mistake of talking about the Acela and making complaints about the Acela.
And now we've reached it.
We've done it. We've
walked through that door.
I was going to complain about Metro North, the commuter rail.
That's okay.
Also slow.
The Acela is not legit. Okay, I'm going to stop it there so we don't further embarrass ourselves. I do want to thank, however, our Slate Plus listeners. You've listened a long time and not heard us talking about the Acela. And because you've listened for so long and because you've supported us through Slate Plus, we've been able to keep going. And you get a lot of great stuff if you're a Slate Plus member. You get bonus segments, discounts on live shows. You get no hitting the paywall on the Slate site. And this week, you'll get a segment where we're going to talk about the Trump civil fraud trial in New York City. So if you're a member, thank you. Enjoy it. If you're not a member, go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. slate.com/GabFestPlus. There will be no Acela content in that. This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Hey everyone, it's MSNBC's Chris Hayes. For the first time since 1892, we have an election in which both candidates have presidential records. It's a chance to take a hard look at what Joe Biden and Donald Trump have actually done as president. On a special Why Is This Happening podcast series called With Pod 2024 The Stakes, I'm talking to experts about the two candidates' records on specific policy areas like immigration, taxes, climate, and more. So you know what's at stake come November. Search for Why Is This Happening and follow.
So I do not watch horror movies, and I also don't watch any popular culture where children are in danger, and I also don't look at polls that make me feel sick. So I confess that I found it, because I'm a good colleague of yours, I did manage to look at the New York Times Siena poll of key states a year out from the presidential election. But the headline results, the results were so depressing and so dire, and they came on top of a series of bad polling results for Biden. And it just looks awful for Biden. It looks awful. John, please summarize this absolutely grim poll if you are a Democrat, I should note. Very exciting if you're a Trump supporter or a Republican.
So the poll finds that in six of the key battleground states, some of them are swing states, some of them aren't. We can talk about that later. But in six of the key battleground states, Trump has a meaningful lead a year out. Meaningful means it's outside of the margin of error. And these results are not because Trump is getting stronger, really. They're really the result of Biden's growing weakness. His two biggest problems, and the reason this is a, and by the way, I'll just, the states I should say are Wisconsin, Nevada, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Georgia, and Arizona. Did I get that right? Five of those six states flipped from Donald Trump to Joe Biden from 16 to 20. So those would be swing states, although I prefer to call them all battleground states. Nevada lost, Trump lost twice. But he's ahead in the polls there. The polls find essentially that Biden has trouble within his base with younger voters, voters of color. He also, two of his biggest problems are age and the economy. And the reason that makes people feel so nervous who are supporters of his or who would not like Donald Trump to be elected is that those are two very, very hard things to fix. Age, you can't fix at all. And the economy, while, and we should talk about this, there's a real disconnect between actual economic numbers and people's opinions about the economy. It's very hard to tell people not to feel what they're feeling. And the numbers in some of these states on who do you trust on the economy for Donald Trump are upwards of 20 points of voters saying they trust Trump over Biden. So could you do the magic to get people to change that position, which is another reason people feel this is a tough poll for Democrats. The alternative is that the weaknesses in Democratic constituencies, young men, Black voters, Latinos, that they'll come back once they see all the great things Joe Biden has done. This is the Democratic case. And also once they learn about the alternative, and this is particularly true of young voters, the alternative both in terms of Donald Trump, but also if you watch the Republican debate on Wednesday night and heard Republican candidates talking about their climate, their energy policy, if you're a young voter, and particularly like a kind of a Bernie Sanders young Democratic voter, and you're disaffected with Joe Biden, and you hear what the Republican Party wants in terms of energy policy, it is likely to be very, very opposite to your policy preferences. The Democratic case goes that once all those voters learn those things, they will come back home to Biden and they will be more revolted by Donald Trump. There was not so much negative partisanship in this poll as there might be in an actual election.
I mean, that goes with one of my theories about Joe Biden, which is that people get they're not excited about him, but they don't have like viscerally furious feelings. I don't think I have a lot of evidence for my about this. I don't think it's something that pollsters ask, but it's just my gut feeling, which I will put out there, which goes with the idea that he could win these voters back.
Yeah, although they do think he's doddering.
Yeah,
yeah, that's a problem.
I mean, that is one of the things that Nate Cohen made when he made when he was talking about this poll is that actually the attributes inside of Biden that used to actually be the reason people were voting for him. Questions about temperament and whether, like, those have all dropped. And that interests me as well, because age, one understands. Questions about mental sharpness, you can understand how people could come to those conclusions. But the temperament question, I mean, it's not like he's gone flying off the handle.
At all.
I mean, obviously, people don't have extra precise renditions of what these words mean.
Yeah, I sort of feel like you could go from age and mental acuity into temperament pretty easily without, is no evidence of him flying off the handle. We haven't seen all that much of him. He's been, I mean, as far as I can tell, he seems like he's been himself perfectly.
But I'm not sure that steady pair of hands quality, which people liked in 2020, is so valuable. If people are like, well, it was a steady pair of hands, but man, there was so much inflation. And we're at war everywhere, and there's still immigrants pouring over the border. Who cares? It's time for change.
We are not at war everywhere. The United States.
The world is at war. The world is at war.
No, I think you've made an important point, which is you can't slice the bologna too thin. And so a general disaffection with the president filters out through a variety of different metrics and doesn't necessarily correlate to somebody sitting down and going, now let me think about presidential temperament. What do I mean by that? And do the facts really match my conception of this?
Emily, I think the interesting numbers in this poll, which seem to track what appears to be happening in the world, is that a much larger number of Black voters are considering voting for Trump than voted for him before, or than have ever voted for a Republican presidential candidate post-civil rights movement. Huge percentage of Hispanic voters. To me, it seems manifestly good that there be a diverse Republican Party. I would wish it was not a diverse Republican Party that was united behind a monstrous conservative populist of the Trump sort. But it seems nice that they're that the parties have to compete for voters, that people just don't sort by their race. Do you have a sense about why Black and Hispanic voters in particular, and I think Asian American voters too, are breaking towards Republicans?
I mean, we should say it's not a majority of Black voters. No. It's just more than
22%.
Right. It's just given that the Black vote has been so much like 90% Democratic. And I think it was like half of Latino voters overall. I think that people don't like having their votes taken for granted. And that when you vote repeatedly for the same party and you feel like your life isn't getting better, that's deflating. And things like inflation really hit people who don't have lots of money. And, you know, you have disproportionate poverty among Black and Hispanic voters. So maybe that's part of what's going on. I also have seen some very clever social media directed specifically at Latino voters from the Trump side, like videos on TikTok that just seem like they're pretty good. Like, they're kind of meant to go viral. They seem like they're the kind of rappers you would not imagine supporting Trump, being like totally down for Trump and kind of making it subversively hip to be in that position. And I wonder if that's having some effect on younger voters.
One of the figures that's kind of striking on the younger voter front is that, and this comes from, I think this is Daniel Cox's analysis in AEI, but among all registered voters in all the battleground states who are under age 30, Trump and Biden are essentially tied in the New York Times Siena poll. But when you look at those voters who are most likely to vote, Biden has a 6-point lead. But that's way worse than his 26-point margin he had with that same group nationally in 2020. And I think some of what's behind that maybe is you look at the leaders above you, if you're a young person, and you think, man, they're all old and they have no connection to my life. And this is a point Daniel Cox made, is that he pointed to the Pew topography survey. And there's a group that Pew identifies as the outside left, which is basically, think of them as the Sanders voter. They are liberal. They don't like Republicans, but they are not institutionalists. In fact, they view anybody who kind of wants to maintain the institutions as a way to achieve progressive priorities. It just doesn't get the trick. Like, that person is not interesting to them. They don't think, even if they share the same policy goals, they don't think somebody who believes the institutions are fit for for bringing those goals about is a person worth supporting. And so they might just bail on the whole process.
Oh, God. We've talked actually a little bit less about Trump than you would normally expect us to have talked so far. And that's, I think, one of the point of these polls is that Trump is the candidate who they are polling Biden against, and that's who the head-to-head matchup is. But Trump has been not that visible to the world. The active Biden versus Trump campaign is not going on. Also, Trump's criminal trials have not started or completed yet. And I wonder, John, there was a little bit of evidence in the polling that suggests, oh, if Trump is criminally convicted, that would be quite damaging for him in the polls. And there's certainly the kind of intuitive sense that I have that the more Trump is front and center with people, the more they are reminded of the kind of awfulness and chaos and cruelty and destructiveness of him, and thus less likely to vote for him. But that could just be wishful thinking on my part.
No, I think it's not impossible. I mean, here's another thing that there's no particular evidence for, but that strikes me, is that I wonder if he's convicted, whether people will think it's a national embarrassment to vote for a president who is convicted. Like, just the kind of patriotic muscle will kick in and say, we cannot as Americans. It's sort of like, it made me think of the Italians, the way they felt about Berlusconi. It was just like, this has just gone beyond. Like, you can't elect a person who's been convicted, you know, assuming people think the conviction is merited, which I think the polls show that at least they're very open to that possibility, given what they think about Trump and about the facts of these various cases. So I don't think it's crazy. I think also, if you look at, it's not just reminding people about what the former president did, but like, nobody's really polled what he said he will do. You start, I think if you start talking about that, there's a possibility for things to significantly change. One other thing I would say about younger voters is that there's some evidence in the polling that they have no idea what Biden has done. Like, they're just not paying any attention. And in fact, they're wrong about some of the things they think, that they're basically voting like on vibes. And can you change that? I don't know. I mean, that's one of the great questions that Biden has to face, and that is a real challenge for him, is first of all, what's the actual problem? It doesn't seem to be a party problem. Party's doing pretty well. So what's Biden's actual problem, and can he fix it?
And what if it's just that he's old?
Yeah. So it does seem that Election Day this year showed that Democrats won despite Biden. And therefore, if you were a party poobah, it might make you think, man, we do urgently need to consider an alternative. We're good on the issues. We just have this leader who's not there. Is the idea of an alternative just dead duck? Is it hopeless? Or could a Newsom or Pritzker or Whitmer, obviously, if Biden has a health problem, then that becomes real. But absent a health problem, could somebody, and somebody who is not Kamala Harris, step forward and actually assume this role? Or is it just, it's just fatally flawed as a plan? It's too Rube Goldberg. It couldn't work. They will have flaws. And it's just a pipe dream.
Normally, I'm very skeptical about the unicorn candidate. And that's why I felt that way about Glenn Youngkin. This like cockamamie plan that some Republican donors had, that somehow Youngkin, when there were already approximately 712 candidates who had tried to be the anti-Trump, could somehow jump in and be the successful anti-Trump, was silly. And so I have a feeling about that here too. The Democratic Party tends to have a lot of voters in it who want to have their say. And if somehow some arrangement were made where a person was tapped to be the replacement for Biden, there would be a lot of voters, I think, and particularly party activists, who'd be like, wait a minute, who gave you the power to tap this person, whether it's Newsom or somebody else. One of the interesting things inside the New York Times poll of those six battleground states is that Kamala Harris actually does better than Biden and basically solves a great deal of these problems within the Democratic coalition. And so that tees up something quite interesting, which is it would be easier in terms of a razzle-dazzle play to hand off to Harris, just in terms of just like logistics and it looks reasonable because you're handing it off to your vice president, than to pilot in or drop in the governor of California. But I think there's also some considerable nervousness about her ability to carry out a candidacy in terms of her just raw political skill. So I generally think it's too much of a trick play. But when David Axelrod, who knows something about politics, kind of suggests this, it made me think, this isn't just kind of the donor class throwing out sallies of wild opinion while they go to get another gin and tonic. It's somebody who has actual experience running campaigns.
I had a question a few minutes ago when we were talking about the slice of the left, the young slice of the left. Do you all think that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is having a significant effect on their viewpoints, and will that stick? I mean, on campuses right now, it's like a huge thing, and people are really, I think, having taking a kind of very like binary view of the conflict that doesn't have a whole lot of historical context, I would argue. But there's a lot of very heartfelt sloganeering going on.
The Times poll was done before, I think, the conflict.
October 7th.
I don't think it helps. If you look at the Republican debate on Wednesday night, and I know this isn't the way it's going to be sorted, but I mean, all the responses from the Republican debate were like, kill. I mean, they were so responses in America after the day after 9/11. I mean, it was, and the reason I think that's interesting is that at the same time you had some of the candidates, Ramaswamy and DeSantis and stuff, saying like, well, we're not going to get involved in these things and spend all these money overseas. But the kind of response they were advocating for Hamas, to destroy Hamas, was and then bomb Iran. So anyway, there was a real like disconnect. They were promoting bombing Iran. But my point is that if you were looking as a choice, you might not like what Biden wants to do, but the Republican position is even further to the right than Biden.
But I think Emily, entombed in your question, embedded in your question, I don't think is the idea that these voters are going to go to Trump. It's that they're just not going to vote. They're not going to come out for Biden.
Correct.
And they're going to be mad at Biden, too, and that they see him as the enemy.
Yeah. You're 100% right about all that. Yes.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know, there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next. And I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So the Supreme Court seemed well positioned to block every restrictive gun law in the nation after their decision last year in the Bruin case. But this court had not yet met Zaki Rahimi, one of the least sympathetic Supreme Court petitioners you could ever hope to hear from. Emily, please tell us the amazing facts about Mr. Rahimi.
Mr. Rahimi, so what's at issue in this case is a civil protective order that Mr. Rahimi was subject to because he was accused of assaulting an ex-girlfriend, including like dragging her by the hair. And then on, I think remarkably, like five times within 2 months, he was shooting a gun. One time it was because he didn't like the service a friend of his was getting at a restaurant, so he fired a gun into the air. But also he like shot into the home of someone he had just sold drugs to. So he's really not a good poster child for Second Amendment broad individual right to bear arms. What happened was that after he committed some of these shootings, the cops came to his house and realized that he had weapons that he was not allowed to have because of the protective order. And the reason for that is that in 1994, Congress passed a law concerned about the harms of domestic and intimate partner violence that said that you could, that people who are subject to protective orders cannot have weapons anymore. And that's the law that's at issue in this case. It's called 922G. It's a federal law. A lot of states have laws like this too, and they are basically a modern recognition of the problem of having weapons available to someone who is posing a credible threat of domestic violence, because we know there is so much harm and danger, especially to women, that comes from that circumstance.
Five times more likely to be killed by a domestic abuser who has a gun than not.
Yeah, if there's a gun present. Exactly. And the Supreme Court has talked about the problem of domestic violence in previous cases. The problem the court has created for itself, and I think that it will solve this problem, but the problem it has created is that in its last case about gun rights, the court said that a modern gun law can only stand, can only pass muster with the Second Amendment if it is in accord with our history and tradition as a nation. And the question in this case, and it's really an important one, is what that means. So the most narrow view, which is the view that the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals case in siding with Zaki Rahimi, is that, well, you know, at the founding of the country, there were no laws that said that you disarmed someone because of a domestic violence threat. So you can't do it now. You know, there's obviously a just huge democratic problem with that view because women couldn't vote. I mean, we're talking about imposing a really, one hopes, different colonialist set of values and concerns on the modern era. And so what the United States, what the Solicitor General was trying to argue to the court is like, we got to think about history and tradition at a much higher level of generality, that as long as you can look back and see that the founders and other people along the historical tradition disarmed people who were dangerous. You can apply that principle in this case, and this is a modern conception of dangerousness, and that's fine because we always had this idea of disarming dangerous people. I think that that view will prevail given the argument, but it's interesting to watch the court try to get out of this trap it set for itself the last time around.
And Emily, you think they're going to find a way to write around it, which is undoubtedly the case.
What do you mean to write around or to write around it?
The problem they've set themselves by believing that the Second Amendment is linked so closely to the intent and the world as it was in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, like that they'll just find a way to write around that and say, well, subsequent events that they'll allow a living constitution for the purposes of not being totally absurd. And by the way, one of my favorite exchanges in the argument was when the Chief Justice asked Matthew Wright, who was the federal public defender, he said, "You don't have any doubt that your client's a dangerous person, do you?" And Wright gave an answer that's very familiar from, if you paid attention to any of the Trump cases, where Wright's wondered, well, what does a dangerous person mean? As if that was a legitimate question to ask. And Robert said, well, I mean, someone who's shooting, you know, at people. That's a good start. But anyway, back to what I was saying, which is, Emily, they're going to find a way to write around this. Do you think, though, that it provides a way to talk about this inconsistency between a constitution defined by the framers that's stuck or a living constitution for future cases? In other words, does it become a shorthand for this inconsistency?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of larger question at stake, right? So there's a couple ways to think about this case. One is that the Fifth Circuit just went kind of like crazy here, right? That Zaki Rahimi is so clearly not someone who should be having a gun. There's like a common sense problem with its application of this history and tradition doctrine. And so the court is going to find a way to rein it in. But we also have the same history and tradition test now with regard to the 14th Amendment, which is like where we have pinned all our liberty rights. So same-sex marriage and abortion and the right to have birth control and sexual liberty. All of those cases, and this is the result of Dobbs, the opinion that overturned Roe versus Wade, we're also in the land of in accord with our history and tradition. And so if the court answers in this Rahimi case, oh, you know what? You can just look back for principles that the founders espoused, but they don't have to be like really specific. We don't have to have specific historical evidence of a tradition. Then they're not going to be able to do the same kind of conservative work that it looked like they were doing in Dobbs and in the previous case, right? It looked like what the conservative goal here was is to make it really hard to address modern problems that were not in line with traditionalist values, right? So like, think about same-sex marriage for a second. Is same-sex marriage in accord with our history and tradition? Well, if you think about like whether we had legalized gay marriage in the 18th and 19th century, well, obviously the answer is no. If you think about some developing, evolving notion of equality and liberty and the idea that like the framers cared about equality and liberty and maybe they used these majestic phrases deliberately so that they could evolve over time, well, then it's all fine. But it seemed like that was not what the conservative justices were interested in allowing. And so that's the sort of broader set of issues here.
Can I make a dumb point that it was the result of only knowing a little bit, which is when we talk about the founders and the framers, you know, Jefferson believed the Constitution, I think one of his letters, but I think he believed essentially the Constitution should be re-upped every 19 or 20 years, like zero-based budgeting for the Constitution. You have to rewrite it, which would be really interesting. I'm surprised there's not like some society that gets together, maybe there is, every 19 years and rewrites the Constitution based on things at the moment. But the argument was essentially one generation can't bind another. So you could say, well, one of the founders believed this, but he's not a framer because he wasn't at the Constitutional Convention. So,
yes, well, he lost that argument generally. But yes, it is. They did talk about these issues at the time.
No, and it's there's this amazing passage from Ulysses Grant, which I've quoted on the show before, which I was going to try to find, but I can't because my Google is too slow, where Grant says it is absurd to think that we should be bound. Here we are in 18, you know, 65, that we should be bound by what people who, you know, had no concept of electricity, who had no concept of, you know, the steam engine, who had all these ideas that aren't congruent with where we are today, that we should be bound by their position. But we have cursed ourselves. We've given ourselves like a constitution in amber, and it's going to crush the country. And this court is determined to, you know, make that amber, to burnish that amber, but by no means ever to break it.
Yeah. I mean, it is really interesting to watch that idea. And, you know, Grant is an especially salient person to bring up here because he's speaking right before Reconstruction, which is a kind of second founding era. And one of the kind of amazing things about this court and its view of, you know, history and tradition, which seems to me to just be like an even vaguer, more manipulable version of originalism, right? So you don't even have original meaning is like pinned at 1787. Now you just have some idea of like the swath of history and tradition in which if you're Justice Alito, you can always find the examples you want. But they haven't even settled whether they care the most about 1868, like the year that the 14th Amendment was enacted and ratified, or whether you throw back to the founding, even when you're talking about the 14th Amendment. And Justice Barrett wrote a concurrence last year in Dobbs where she was like, I just note that we haven't really settled on this. And in this case, it doesn't matter, but maybe we should think about this later. It's just kind of crazy that they haven't like even decided that part.
I find some reassurance in the fact that Barrett and Kavanaugh and Roberts do seem to be like basically pragmatic. They're extremely conservative, but they also don't want to take the Supreme Court down some kind of suicidal path. And so it feels like they're going to push the country in very conservative directions, but they are not going to push the country in very conservative directions that are so demented as Alito and Thomas would, where they would probably let Zaki Rahimi have whatever guns he wanted.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Barrett, before she joined the Supreme Court, had an opinion that it was about basically, as I recall, like a white collar defendant and whether that person could have a gun. So there was no issue of dangerousness. And she found on his behalf that he did have a right to bear arms. But that's why I think she and others at the argument this week were putting a lot of weight on this category of dangerousness. And, you know, that does seem like it would give the states and Congress some leeway to legislate here. It's very different, of course, from having like an overall prohibition on handguns, which, you know, cities and some states used to have, but we're way past that.
Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you are like me, not really having any cocktails, I'm on an alcohol strike for reasons I can't really articulate. I'm just not drinking. But if you're having a non-alcoholic cocktail with me, John, what would you be chattering about?
I've got a French double-barreled historical chatter.
That would be legal. That because that was okay during the era of the founding. The French double-barreled rifles were totally used very commonly for hunting. So please proceed.
So the first one is about our dear friend Napoleon. When he returned from exile in 1815. The hat he wore, which is made of beaver felt, it was a bicorn hat, probably the most famous symbol ever worn by a military leader. And he attached a bit of colored ribbon known as a cockade to this hat. And one of them is about to sell for upwards of $850,000, which is just amazing. But I really, that's what lured me into this was the auction of this. There were about 200 Napoleon hats at one point that he wore, and they were, and they're only, I don't know, like 15 or so now. But then what I wondered is, or what I didn't know is that he wore the hat as everybody probably has a mental image of Napoleon in his bicorn hat. He wore it sideways. So most people wore it front to back. And we can leave aside the association of dictatorial leaders and their headwear. But just imagine like a person becomes so powerful by wearing their hat basically sideways.
I mean, people do that with their baseball caps. You have one on right now. You can turn it sideways. It would look a little weird, but... You could.
It would look weird, but imagine then being, I mean, you could turn it sideways and you'd be a TikTok influencer and, you know, you'd maybe get a couple of fancy cars to park in your garage. But I mean, to be like a world leader and wear your hat sideways. Anyway, but the theory for why he wore his hat sideways, there are two of them that seem to rise up out of the mythology. And one is that it made it easier to talk to his men in battle because you didn't have this enormous front piece of the bill, essentially, of the beaver felt hat. And so he turned it sideways. And the other is that obviously it made him easy to recognize in battle. So that's one of my French. And the other is, this is truly one of my favorite things about history, is when there is history that's just sitting somewhere for hundreds of years, untouched, ready to be discovered. And for basically 200 years, there were these bundles of letters of longing and love written by women and wives and mothers to their sons and husbands who were participating in the Seven Years' War, which started in 1753 between the French and the British. And they were just discovered. Basically, a research historian asked the British National Archives, can I look in that box? And what he found were 100 or so letters from members of this French frigate, the Galatea. And they were letters sent to these sailors from, as I said, their wives and their mothers that never reached them. And they'd been bound up for more than 200 years. And so they're all these sweet, you know, this one woman writes to her husband and says, you know, I could spend all night writing to you. I am forever your faithful wife. Have a good evening, my dear friend. It's now midnight. I think it's time for me to rest. So the man to whom she wrote that survived, but she didn't by the time. He never read that letter, of course. And then one mother writes her son, I think more about you than you about me. In any case, I wish you a happy new year filled with blessings of the Lord. This was a mother to her son, and she complained that he hadn't written her back, which is another more proof that things don't change over time. She also died, but he did as well. Anyway, so I think these letters might be online now, but just all of that humanity kind of bound up and hidden for 200 years now sees the light of day.
Emily, what's your chatter?
Oh my God, I have such a trivial chatter compared to that. I, since the COVID era, have been doing jigsaw puzzles at my house, which I find kind of embarrassing, but I really like doing them. And I recently, through a friend, discovered these Liberty puzzles. Have you guys seen these? They're wood, and they have these very, very intricate shapes. They're like thicker than a cardboard jigsaw puzzle, like significantly thicker. And some of the puzzle shapes are like, you know, a little girl holding a broom, or like a witch or a cat or a wheel. They're just made in these very intricate way. They're also really expensive, which is a drag. One of the things I like about my jigsaw puzzle habit is that jigsaw puzzles normally cost like $20 to $30. And I think the Liberty ones are more like $80 to over $100. So I am not going to develop a whole habit of Liberty puzzles. But if you like puzzles and you don't know about these puzzles, they are really cool and they would make a good gift.
What I love about this, Emily, is they're tactile. I mean, the wooden pieces, oh man, I could just basically play around with them without even connecting them. But I misunderstood. I thought what you meant was that the entire image of the puzzle was a girl dancing. No, the individual pieces are not those misshapen weird things that look like an egg that got dropped wrong. They are actually themselves pieces of art. Fabulous.
Yes. Although some of the puzzles also don't have like a full rectangle. They're like we have one that's a stork, and it's like the puzzle is the shape of the stork. But yes, the individual pieces have all these intricate patterns.
My chatter, if anything, is even more trivial. Your chatter was not trivial, Emily. Your chatter was filled with beauty and joy in the world and excitement.
Oh my God, yes. I am buoyed up. I am absolutely levitating at that.
My chatter is, so I saw this item in Hey DC, the CityCast DC newsletter, but it pointed to a story in Washingtonian, the city magazine here in DC, by Jessica Sidman. Why is Dallas on the cover of this DC guidebook? And it's a guide to this phenomenon, which is apparently there are now AI generated travel guidebooks, and there are some for DC. And so Jessica Sidman got them. And what's in these AI? I know we should be alarmed by AI. It's developing so quickly. We should be chastened that these writers of real travel books are, you know, now being co-opted by these fake AI travel books.
But you're thrilled. You have a gleam in your eye.
No, but it's so funny. It is so, so funny, the stuff that is in it. Like, boating is allowed on Rock Creek Lake, which is located in the park's northern region. There is no Rock Creek. There's nothing called Rock Creek Lake. it imagined Rock Creek Lake. Don't miss out on the creamy and soothing tastes of the iconic DC half and half, a blend of sweet tea and lemonade. It's like, what? First of all, sweet tea and lemonade would not be creamy, but that's not a drink. That doesn't exist. My favorite one is this. Apparently, one of the big DC festivals is the Walla Walla Sweet Onion Celebration. The celebration commemorates the legendary Walla Walla Sweet Onions. Like, for Washington, D.C., it's just awesome. Anyway, I love when AI goes wrong and these D.C. guidebooks. Also, they're all written by imaginary people. Jorge B. Smith, William Jose, Jessica J. White. They're not real people. Listeners, you have real chatters, however, and you email them to us at gabfest@slate.com, something that you're talking about. And this week's chatter comes to us from Massachusetts, or it's about Massachusetts, from Sheila McIntyre.
Hello, GabFest. Sheila McIntyre from Ottawa, Ontario here. My cocktail chatter involves a news story about a group of wealthy summer residents of Truro, Massachusetts on Cape Cod, who conspired to commit massive voter fraud by switching their legal voting residence simply so they could vote in the town meeting on October 21st. Why? To vote against the building of new affordable housing. The NIMBYism is strong in this rich, beachy enclave in true blue liberal Massachusetts as they mounted a collective effort to essentially overthrow town government. Sophie Manshafir, a Cub reporter for the wonderful local newspaper, the Provincetown Independent, broke the story. A lawyer with the Commonwealth, Dan Sullivan, said that in 46 years practicing election law, he couldn't remember a situation when non-residents were trying to take over a town. Summonses are imminent. The Board of Registrars will hear challenges to almost half of the new voter registrations, and the town meeting was postponed to November 2nd. Stay tuned.
That's our show for today. The GabFest is produced by Shana Roth, our researcher is Julie Hugin. Julie, by the way, worked very hard at the polls because Julie is a really good citizen. So I would just like to note that Julie, in addition to being our researcher, was working at the polls in Colorado because she is not just doing awesome research, but helping democracy grease the wheels of democracy. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations, and Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio. For Slate, please email your conundrums to us at slate.com/conundrums. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week. Hi, Slate Plus. How are you? Emily wants to talk about the Trump civil trial, where all the Trump boys testified, then former President Trump testified, then Ivanka testified this week. Why do you want to talk about this, Emily?
I'm anxious to talk about it, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of incredible that this is happening. So, you know, before this is a trial. The Attorney General of New York has accused the Trumps of running a fraudulent enterprise, the Trump Organization in New York State. And she is seeking damages, but also the penalty that they would never be able to do business in New York State again, which is huge. I mean, this is Trump's entire business empire, the kind of foundation of his whole self-image. And the accusations are that he so vastly inflated the worth of various properties that he was intentionally defrauding the people of New York. Before the trial started, the judge ruled that, yes, indeed, he had committed fraud. Or I should say that the Trump Organization had committed fraud. And so this entire trial is really about the penalties. It's important, though, that the Trumps are testifying, because in a civil matter, as opposed to a criminal matter, if you don't testify, the court can hold it against you. So they have a really strong incentive to show up and try to explain themselves. And yet, in various ways, they are just showing such contempt for any kind of like accountability, basic idea that when you sign a document, you're supposed to have some sort of responsibility for its contents. I just think it's been kind of incredible to watch them march through.
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.
I'm Dahlia Lithwick, and I'm host of Amicus, Slate's podcast about the law and the U.S. Supreme Court. We are shifting into high gear, coming at you weekly with the context you need to understand the rapidly changing legal landscape. The many trials of Donald J. Trump, judicial ethics, arguments and opinions at SCOTUS. We are tackling the big legal news with clarity and insight every single week. New Amicus episodes every Saturday, wherever you listen.